This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, does Governor J.B. Pritzker's budget make the state's pension problem even worse? We'll find out what an analysis shows. Also, a former state lawmaker has a new podcast to explain state government. And as Illinois pushes toward making recreational marijuana legal, what about diversity in the industry? We've been reporting on efforts to solve the state's teacher shortage. Today we hear how one assistant has struggled to make the move toward being a full-time teacher.
I want to be a teacher because I'm a leader. I have ideas and gifts and insights and instincts, and it's hard to be a paraprofessional when you're a leader.
Can the system be changed to help? We'll discuss that and more coming up on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A lot coming up this hour. With Illinois facing a teacher shortage, we'll look at the hurdles for paraprofessionals who want to become teachers. Also, a change is ahead for calculating flood insurance, and it will impact how much homeowners pay, we'll explain. And when it comes to Governor Pritzker's budget proposal, what do the numbers show regarding state pension contributions? That and more is on the way.
I'm Daisy Contreras for Statewide. Sometimes us political journalists get caught up in the bubble that is state government. We know it's not always the easiest of jobs, especially because sometimes the issues can be a little tricky to explain. To talk about that complexity, I'm joined by Chicago activist and artist Glennon Screen and former state lawmaker Daniel Biss. Both have teamed up to host a new podcast called Ill Informed. Glennon's, Daniel, thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Now, I guess a good starting point is the title of the podcast. It's not Illinois Informed. It is Ill Informed. There's a play on words here, though. Does this really embody what the podcast is about?
I think so. I think there's a lot of misconceptions and misunderstandings about how state politics run and function. And so through this podcast, it just allows us to have a wonderful opportunity to deconstruct those things and really inform the folks of Illinois of things that maybe we are hoping that we might be learning and wanting to know, but just don't have access to that information.
You know, for me, this podcast is for anybody who is curious about how to change state government, knows what kind of changes they'd want to see, doesn't have a point of contact that can help them understand where to even necessarily start.
Now, before we do go on, I want to listen to a brief clip from one of your latest episodes where the fun topic is partisanship.
Most times when we think about partisanship, we think about donkeys and elephants and all of that, a two-party system, blah, blah, blah. We all know. But today's episode...
We'll have no blah, blah, blah at all. We mean something kind of different, I think, than what people often have in mind. So I'm not talking about partisan fights or elections where Democrats are running against Republicans. What I want to talk about today is the impact of different types of partisan control of government on what actually happens.
So I'm interested in the dynamics here. The idea is to make sure more people can understand what is actually happening inside the state house without sounding too insider. But at the same time, having that inside knowledge of how things work in state government might actually be helpful for this particular goal that you're trying to achieve. Glennon's, with your background and experiences, what do you hope you're bringing to the table during your podcast discussions?
I'm hoping that I'm bringing a lay perspective that other people across the state have and are perhaps too afraid to speak up about, or are simply disengaged because they just don't understand it. And so, like, my hopes for my role in the podcast is to let folks know that you don't have to be an insider to be civically engaged. You don't have to be an elected official or have gone to school for political science to be actively engaged in the process of making key decisions that are going to be impacting your life chances. So I think my role is very significant in that, right? And that's what makes this particular podcast different from others similar to it.
And Daniel, has it been difficult for you to step away from using certain jargon or to let yourself relax in front of a microphone? You were one of several Democratic gubernatorial candidates. There's a certain way a candidate carries himself. How are you finding that transition, especially for this podcast?
Yeah, I love it. You know, I always most enjoyed myself when I was in office and when I was running. When I was able to use normal language and kind of help people peek behind the curtain. And I used to be really, really blunt and direct and kind of break some of the rules about what legislators are or are not supposed to say. But you're right that you still, when you're in politics, there's this kind of guardedness and a kind of care that you have to take. And it's been really, really fun to just kind of let loose a little bit and be very blunt and very direct and hopefully illuminate some things that are hard for people who are still in office to be truly, truly blunt about.
Some people might argue that the podcast industry is reaching a point of saturation where just about anyone can put a podcast together. How do you both expect to stand out and break through that noise with Ill-Informed?
I think for a lot of our listeners, there's a very comedic aspect of this, and not because it's all so funny, but it's very ironic. There's a lot of things that we kind of pull back the curtain on that I'm learning for the first time. Like, this is new information for me as well. When we prepare for these episodes, I'm like, did this thing really happen? Or sometimes we're on air when Daniel, you know, he's telling the details of these stories. I am very much, those are real life surprise reactions. I'm reacting to what I'm hearing as any other common person would.
That was Chicago activist and artist Glennis Green and former state lawmaker Daniel Biss talking about their new podcast, Ill-Informed.
Leaders from community colleges and universities across northern Illinois recently met to brainstorm how to close college completion gaps based on race and income levels. Peter Midland has more on that.
In the fall of last year, over 20 schools joined with the Partnership for College Completion to launch the Illinois Equity and Attainment Initiative. The schools share what works for them, and the PCC helps orchestrate a plan unique to their school and give them more information about the reality of the equity issue. Lisa Castillo Richmond is the partnership's managing director. She says the gaps in Illinois mostly mirror those seen across the country. However, there are aspects of the issue where Illinois stands out.
We are a significant outlier, I would say, in terms of the gap between white students completing college degrees in Illinois and African-American students. In 6 years from a four-year institution, white students will graduate at about a rate of 66%, while African-American students are graduating at about half that rate, at about 33%.
And similar gaps existed among other races and classes. Organizers say it was essential for their initiative to be made up of a diverse group of schools, 2- and 4-year, big and small, public and private, in order to show how gaps persisted everywhere.
You know, we really wanted to move away from the fallacy that says if you just get students into the right institution, everyone is graduating at these equitable and high rates.
They all face the same problem. For some, the disparity was 6 or 8%. For others, it could exceed 10 or even 20%. And why did they want to meet now? Well, across the state in aggregate, the gaps weren't getting any better, and in some cases, they were widening. The event itself was held at Northern Illinois University's Naperville campus. Lisa Freeman is the president of NIU.
What we're saying is it's really the responsibility of the university to meet the students that we accept where they are and to recognize that sometimes when a student doesn't succeed, it's not on them, it's actually on us, on the systems we've created that are serving our students poorly.
She says NIU's been looking at their graduation equity rate even before they joined the initiative, but it's been easier to start acting on it since the end of the state's budget impasse. For NIU, that's meant making sure students have support during their financial aid process and raising awareness for other academic resources. They've also seen through their Promise Scholars program how research can help connect students, especially students of color, to their campus and increase their odds of retention. Confronting and analyzing equity data has been a key part of the plan at Wilbur Wright College. They're a 2-year school and one of the city colleges of Chicago. David Potash is the president. He said their plan has been in effect for a few years now. They've been deciphering where student success gaps are happening so they can home in on the sources of the problem. Wilbur Wright's population is 2/3 Hispanic. One improvement area they found was with Hispanic female biology students. They saw those students were dropping out close to when they should have been finishing their programs. So to help fix that, they assigned students farther along in the program to peer mentor students with less experience.
I mean, this is not rocket science, but it's looking at the data, finding people who are motivated, gather and care, and then you make a change.
Schools are also using technology to close the completion gap. The keynote speaker at NIU Naperville was Tim Rennick of Georgia State University. He spoke about his school's success using an AI chatbot to answer common questions from incoming freshmen, anything from FAFSA to housing.
We had students repeatedly tell us that they asked the chatbot questions they wouldn't have asked a human being. If you can't get your biological father to sign the FAFSA because you haven't seen him for the last 2 years, you don't necessarily want to go into some stranger's office and spill out your personal, you know, family history.
NIU President Freeman also has plans to implement a similar chatbot, while they also continue to teach the faculty and staff how to have conversations about equity.
Nobody wants to inadvertently send a student the message that maybe this isn't for you. But people need to learn when they do those kinds of things unconsciously.
Aside from the individual school plans, the PCC is also promoting policies at the state level to alleviate some of the pressure. Castillo Richmond says with so many schools buying into the initiative, there's still plenty colleges can do, even without extra aid coming from Springfield. I'm Peter Mudlin.
Students in the School of Business at Northern Illinois University held what they call their Golden Heart Celebration. That ceremony honored two of their own who were killed in an office shooting that took place in Aurora on February 15th, senior Trevor Wehner and alumnus Clay Parks. Susan Stevens has details.
Undergraduate Research and Artistry Day at NIU, or Poster Day, is an end-of-semester showcase for student projects. And that's where students in Professor Mahesh Subramani's Management 460 class showed how they used their HR skills to cope with the worst they can expect in their profession.
The name of our presentation is Sense Making During an Experiential Learning Project.
That's Kaylee Tasbier, one of seven students in the advanced HR class. It's usually a free-form class where students work together to consult with companies and create human resource management strategies. This semester, it's different.
So we started off as seven students. Right away, we started an inside joke.
Yusuf Judah says they dubbed themselves the Seven Dwarves, and that makes Professor Subramani Snow White.
It was kind of a first symbol of how we were as a family and how we kind of came together so quick. And it's still kind of something that we like to relate ourselves back to. You know, we are still the Seven Dwarves, and we are still seven of us together.
The Seven Dwarves were only about a month into the semester when the unthinkable happened. One of them, Trevor Wehner, was shot and killed on the first day of his internship. He was working with NIU graduate Clay Parks, who was HR director at Henry Pratt Company in Aurora. The two were killed, along with three others, by an employee who was being fired. It happened on a Friday. The class didn't meet again until Tuesday. Judah says the weekend was painful, and they were ready to reunite. They had ribbons honoring Trevor and Clay. They brought yellow roses to symbolize friendship, and there were counselors waiting for them.
We all walked in together. We waited at the top of the stairs for each other, hugged all of our professors as we came inside, and actually placed those yellow roses on Trevor's spot, really signifying that, you know, you're still with us, we love you, you're our friend, we miss you. And that whole entire class was just about coping with it, talking about it, and sharing stories, which was really nice as well. So that's a really memorable moment we had.
It was such a warm feeling that I was finally with people that, you know, felt the same way I did. We were all hurting together.
We put everything on hold for a good 2 weeks. These projects that we started the semester off with were no longer even in our line of vision. You know, we just really dropped everything and focused on rebuilding as a group, coping and healing, and also, you know, carrying on those legacies for Trevor and Clay.
You can't stick with the syllabus in this case. As their professor, Mahesh Subramani says his rational side had to take a backseat to his emotional side.
I've tried to always be flexible and adaptable in order to get students to learn and grow. This has been a very different kind of an opportunity where I had to sort of put on my big boy trousers and then figure out, as this is unraveling, this entire semester was unraveling in front of me and your lives were sort of being so dramatically impacted, I had to think about what to do and sort of lay the tracks as I was sort of driving the locomotive over it. And so it was a process of learning for me.
And the process began with putting their feelings about Trevor Wehner down on paper. Yusuf Judah says there was one point everyone made: what Trevor said the last time they saw him. They were role-playing in class and were asked how they would know when they were successful in life.
And Trevor right away answered that, you know, once everyone remembers his name and remembers him, is how he knows that he has been successful. And really, that was the last moment that we kind of really shared with Trevor. That was our last class right before the event. And it really sunk into us. It's really that last day of class and how, you know, he wanted to be remembered.
Now, they needed to find a better way for people to remember Trevor's name. Kaylee Tasbier.
We have been striving to endow a scholarship called the Golden Heart in honor of Trevor and Clay, because they were both known to their family, friends, and peers prior to passing as people who had hearts of gold.
They'll grant scholarships to students pursuing careers in human resources with money raised so far. They hope to raise $50,000 so the scholarship fund can be self-sustaining. The Seven Dwarves leave another legacy: the research they put into this process.
Within life, school, business, work, everything, they teach you how to make decisions, but they don't teach you how to make sense of something that catastrophically happens to you. You know, you still, people expect you to still like go on with life and the normal things that you were supposed to, but it's really hard to do so. So this has really taught us how to cope with that and to deal with it.
The students concluded that the role of a leader is to help people make sense of catastrophes and foster resilience. Friendships are the key to survival. And they would never forget their seventh team member, Trevor Wehner.
What Trevor really meant for me was really like one of the first people I really got to know at NIU, and someone that like I could always relate to, and like someone that always had my back. That last class that we had with him, I always wish that it ended in a different way. You know, him telling us that like we could remember him, and you never like get to tell someone how much you really cared about them when they left. So, yeah, I'm gonna miss him.
And with that, Yusuf Judah's colleagues pulled in close to him. They have his back. I'm Susan Stevens.
You're listening to Statewide, and up next, paraprofessionals make low wages teaching the kids who are hardest to reach. So why is it so difficult for these specialists to qualify to become teachers? We'll hear more. That's on the way. Welcome back to Statewide. On the way, what we still don't know about those profiting from the medical marijuana program in Illinois, and the concerns people have on the effort to make cannabis legal for recreational use. But up next, while Illinois is struggling with a teacher shortage, some potential teachers are finding barriers to getting a license, and our education reporter Dusty Rhodes introduces us to one of those aspiring teachers.
It's Tuesday morning at East Moline Middle School, and Kelly McConaughey checks in with a special education student who seems even more reluctant than usual to go to class.
You don't want to be here. Could you hear?
He doesn't say anything inappropriate, but to protect his privacy, I'm going to bleep his voice.
There's not that much school left. No.
He says 28 days.
Okay, so you know exactly. This is approaching the end of your eighth grade school career.
Having acknowledged his feelings, she's now nudging him toward a more positive attitude.
Can we just enjoy the time we had? It's not that bad, is it? I mean, summer's coming.
At least it's not snowing anymore.
Okay, so take some energizing breaths and...
You heard that right. He just took a really deep breath.
All right, have a nice day.
She's worked with this student for several years, but some of her kids are harder to reach.
They might be laying on the floor in the hall, refusing or cussing or punching things.
She's been cussed out, called names, threatened, and hit. And over the 11 years she's been on this job, she's had to break up a few fights. But McConaughey isn't a teacher. Her job title is paraprofessional. It's the position that used to be called teacher's aide, and duties typically included copying worksheets. Not anymore.
No, that would be a wasted opportunity to have another human being work with our children. So everybody makes their own copies these days.
That's McConaughey's boss, Kristen Humphreys. He's superintendent of East Moline Schools, where about 45 paraprofessionals are employed.
There's a continuum of services that our paraprofessionals offer in East Moline Schools and probably across most school districts. We have paraprofessionals that work with kids that are struggling readers, all the way to the paraprofessionals that work with emotionally disturbed children.
McConaughey works at the latter end of that spectrum, with students whose behaviors are too disruptive for a traditional classroom. It's a job she stumbled into with zero training.
What happened was my daughter was in elementary school, and I ended up picking her up from school at 5 at night, and then the winter is dark, and I was like, I can't do this.
At the time, McConaughey was working at a lab, filing insurance papers, but she had 60 hours of college credits.
In art, but hey, they took it, so.
So in Illinois, that's one of three ways to qualify to be a paraprofessional.
So I applied, and I was hired. Well, I ended up being good at it.
McConaughey knew she'd found her calling.
You are helping them with social skills and how to get along and how to behave. I mean, the reason that they're having problems is because they're trying to process the world. And that's hard for everyone, but especially for sensitive people.
After 7 years, she realized she wanted to move up from assisting teachers to being a teacher herself. One motive was money. Parapros in Illinois make as little as $8.25 an hour. The average wage is $14 per hour, even for parapros with years of experience. McConaughey, a single mom, celebrated achieving an annual income of $20,000 for the very first time in 2018. However, money was not her only motive.
I want to be a teacher because I'm a leader. I have ideas and gifts and insights and instincts, and it's hard to be a paraprofessional when you're a leader. The teachers here are great. They do use my ideas.
But you're kind of stuck being a nurse and you want to be a doctor.
That's, yes.
While working full-time, she enrolled in online courses through Western Governors University, majoring in special ed and primary education. And everything was going fine until she had to take Illinois' so-called basic skills test, required before student teaching. It's a 5-hour standardized test that covers reading, writing, language arts, and math. McConaughey knew math would be the most difficult section. She just didn't know it was going to include 60 story problems.
There's several parts to each question, so even if you happen to read it right and then decode the question to, you know, perform the function, it's a lot. And then let's say you accidentally don't catch that it's a negative number. There's just a lot that can go wrong, to me, personally.
She's not alone. Only 31% of college students pass the math portion of this test on the first try. Undaunted, she hired a tutor who worked with her more than an hour a day, 7 days a week, for 3 months. McConaughey then took the math portion of the test again and improved her score by 40 points. Better, but not good enough. She continued working with the tutor for another 3 months, and the third time she took the math test, her score actually fell by 3 points. That's when she decided to try another option. Illinois accepts certain scores on the ACT or SAT in lieu of this basic skills test. McConaughey chose the SAT and scored a 990. Illinois demands a score of 1110.
I felt defeated and I was embarrassed and humiliated, you know? I have a lot of people that believe in me. It's heartbreaking.
McConaughey accepted the fact that she couldn't qualify for an Illinois teacher's license and reluctantly changed her major to educational studies. She graduated last weekend, but her diploma came with $40,000 of debt.
Because I thought, I'll just do what people do. They go to college, they get the degree, they get the license, they get the job, and they get the student loan forgiveness for teachers, and that just didn't happen.
Now she's not sure what to do, so she's giving herself the same kind of pep talk she gave her student.
It's hard. It's taught me how to not resent things. It doesn't help me to be resentful of how much I don't make. I chose this. When they hired me, I knew how much they paid, and I chose this. So I have to be grateful. I have to say, I have this job that I love. I have these students that respond to me, and I just have to look at what I do have. I had to practice that a lot, though.
With the state in the grips of a worsening teacher shortage, policymakers are scrambling to find ways to bring more people into the education workforce. And the most critical area of this shortage is special education, the exact area where paraprofessionals work. But currently, there's no clear path to help parapros like Kelly McConaughey become teachers.
You know, Ms. McConaughey wants to teach special education to our students in an elementary or middle school setting. She'll never need that math that they need on that basic skills test.
That's Kristen Humphreys again.
Now, if this is a high school teacher that's going to be teaching math, absolutely. But we have that. There's a content test in the state of Illinois. We've got to get rid of the basic skills test. And I can stand by Ms. McConaughey and I can stand by others. That math test is unnecessary for many of the professions that we have within education.
So, I mean, as a superintendent, how do you feel about arguing for taxpayers to support a teacher and send their children to a teacher who can't hit this certain benchmark in math?
It's a good question. I will take the individual that has the right mindset, that believes in that growth mindset that all kids can learn and they can be something, somebody special, over somebody that has those technical skills, because I can't give someone a heart. I can give them those other skills that we need for them to be successful, to help our kids. Kelly, the skills she has, you can't be taught.
Lawmakers have noticed. Two different bills pending in the General Assembly would remove the requirement for these tests. Teachers would still have to pass specific exams for the subjects they want to teach, plus another test called the EdTPA, and succeed in student teaching. Reporting for Statewide, I'm Dusty Rhodes.
In some places, the common application used by hundreds of colleges and universities will stop asking potential students about their criminal histories. But in Illinois, despite legislative efforts, most campuses continue to ask the question. And seeing that question on a college application can discourage those with criminal records from even applying. The latest attempt to end the practice narrowly failed to move forward in the General Assembly this month. Lee Gaines reported on the topic last year, and we revisit that report.
4 years ago, Chris Miner sat down at his computer and started his application to the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And that's when he saw the question. It asked if he had a criminal record.
This is all done online, and I just sit there and stared at the screen for like 10 minutes. It was like everything, every advancement I made so far might be over with. Maybe this is the end of the ride.
So, Miner lied on the application, and he was accepted. He didn't disclose the fact that in the early 2000s, he was arrested, convicted, and sent to prison for stealing thousands of dollars from a Domino's pizza he worked for. Once Miner started at the U of I, he opened up about his past. He started speaking in public about it and volunteering with organizations that help formerly incarcerated people. Then he decided to apply for a graduate degree at the U of I.
So I'm filling the application. Of course, it's late at nights when I do my best work. And then I came across the question. And yeah, there were tears. I cried. But it was upsetting because I have achieved this at your university. I've given you money. I was on the dean's list every semester I've been there. I graduated. And you're still going to ask me this? You're going to ask anyone this?
This time, Miner was honest about his record, and he was accepted again. But there's a lot of people who don't get as far as Miner did. A 2015 study found that an estimated two-thirds of people with felony convictions who started applications to the State University of New York dropped out of the application process in part because of having to provide information about their criminal records.
There's no evidence that says because Illinois asks these questions that we're safer.
That's Barbara Wheeler. She's a conservative Republican in Illinois' House of Representatives who's tried for the past 3 years to pass legislation that would prevent public universities and colleges from asking the question. So, what's getting in the way? While she's managed to pass it in the House, the bill has stalled in the Senate, and that's largely because nearly every public university in the state opposes the legislation. Despite Wheeler's assertions, Aaron Woodruff says the bill is a threat to student safety. He's the campus police chief for Illinois State University.
Specifically in the areas of sexual violence, my major concern with this bill is that we cannot prevent somebody who's been accused, convicted of sexual assault at another institution. That individual could then apply to ISU or to any of these institutions not have to disclose that, and the university can't use that information to prevent that individual from attending.
There's not a lot of research on this, but what's out there tends to support Wheeler, the state lawmaker. There's no conclusive evidence to suggest that asking about an individual's criminal history during the admissions process decreases campus crime. Wheeler said she's also heard the concern about sexual violence from parents in her district.
I have four daughters, and I hope all of them go through the state program. And I, of course, if I thought for a second that my children would be in danger because of what I'm doing, do you think I would really do it? Of course I wouldn't.
Proponents of banning the box on college applications say the question is doing more harm than good, and the impact is especially profound for people of color. Because blacks are disproportionately represented in prisons, they're also disproportionately affected by policies that ask about criminal records. That's something Chris Miner worries about. He's the formerly incarcerated student at the U of I, and he's also white.
As soon as I got in, I was elated, but not long after, it's like, well, how many people didn't go through with this process? Or did other people, you know, maybe a different color or a different background, did they mark the same answer as I did and get rejected?
Proponents of the legislation say they're going to continue the fight, too. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Again, an update. An effort to ban the box failed to move out of the Illinois House this month. It continues to face opposition from Illinois colleges and universities. Politicians spearheading the effort to legalize recreational marijuana say revenue is not the driving force. They say it's about promoting justice for people of color who've been unfairly targeted by the war on drugs. But in the second installment of our two-part Illinois Issues series, Jacqueline Driscoll reports on the lack of diversity in the state's current legal market, the medical marijuana program.
As negotiations on recreational marijuana continue, one prominent group has not yet taken a stance on the issue, the Legislative Black Caucus. The African-American lawmakers in both the House and Senate are involved in the talks, though.
Any adult use bill has to have specific consideration as it relates to restoring some of the harm that was done during the war on drugs to communities of color. There should be ownership of people of color in this space.
Jahan Gordon Booth is a deputy majority leader of the caucus. The Peoria Democrat says they're taking part because people will be making millions of dollars off a drug that disproportionately harmed minority communities for decades.
We don't want a adult use cannabis program to look like the medical program, which essentially is completely and wholly owned by rich people, and none of them are of color.
Illinois approved its medical marijuana pilot program back in 2013, and politicians tout ours as one of the best, a model for the rest of the country. But it's also an incredibly secretive one. Chris Stone, the CEO of HCI Alternatives, a medical marijuana dispensary in Springfield and the Metro East, sat down with me to talk about the application process he went through years ago.
How are you?
Great. How are you?
Good. Good to see you again.
You too.
We had to do this in a side room off of the dispensary since members of the press are no longer allowed even in waiting rooms without state approval, he says.
Each one of our applications is about 1,800 pages, okay? So we had to provide, I believe it was 6 or 7 copies of that. But we also had to double the number of copies because we had to provide a clean copy and then a redacted copy.
Those applications, both the full copy and the redacted copy, are not available to the public. Stone said they had to redact information
to make sure that when they were viewing the applications, they didn't have the names of anybody in there to affect their judgment. They would look at the redacted copy in terms of the scoring.
When he says they, he means the people who essentially decided who got a license for a dispensary or a cultivation site. Who they are is confidential. I've tried to obtain details through Freedom of Information Act requests, and I'm still trying. There are currently 55 dispensaries and 20 cultivation sites. There's also no public state data available keeping track of who is profiting from them. Many say they want a recreational marijuana program to be more transparent and open.
You have to provide the steps to make things right for the communities that you've hurt all that, you know, all those years.
That's Sunshine Clemens, the founder of Black Lives Matter in Springfield. She gave me her personal opinion because Black Lives Matter hasn't taken a stance yet either.
I believe that we can take the steps to do it where it can provide equity for the Black and brown community that can be legislated.
Just from a monetary standpoint, though, there's a significant barrier. Governor J.B. Pritzker has estimated millions of dollars in next year's budget from legalizing cannabis, and that's only counting the fees to get a license, which he's suggesting will go for $100,000 each. That's not counting the application fees and other expenses. For example, it cost $5,000 just to be able to hand in an application for the medical program. A spokesperson for Pritzker says he is working to ensure justice and equity are core elements of legalization and believes minority entrepreneurs must have the opportunity to succeed. The lead sponsors of making recreational marijuana use legal in Illinois also say equity in the market is a top priority. Here's Representative Kelly Cassidy on how they're working to make sure it happens.
First of all, doing the research, getting the lay of the land to see that across the country this industry is only about 4% minority owned, getting a sense of what states have tried to do to fix for that and where those things have fallen short.
Cassidy says this is what she's most excited about getting right because it could solve problems not just in Illinois, but across the country. As of now, though, details of how they'll ensure this happens remain a mystery. I'm Jacqueline Driscoll.
Next week here on Statewide, we'll present a series of reports titled The State of Cannabis, breaking down what legalized marijuana could mean for Illinois. Up next, we'll take a closer look at Governor Pritzker's plan for state pension contributions. Stay with us for more of Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still ahead, changes in the federal flood insurance program could prove costly for some homeowners. We'll have details. That's on the way. Governor J.B. Pritzker has proposed changes to the state's pension systems. He says this could help the state cover other pressing areas like education, health care, and public safety. But the plan would mean cutting back on pension payments, at least in the short term. That's according to Amanda Cass, the associate director of the Government Finance Research Center at the University of Illinois in Chicago. She talked with Daisy Contreras to break down what the changes mean.
Should people be concerned about this proposal that less money will go into the pension systems?
I think that there's a couple of issues going on with this aspect. So one important thing for listeners to understand, I think, is that part of the way the governor is balancing his proposed 2020 budget is by decreasing the required pension contributions. So rather than raising taxes to increase overall revenue or cut other areas of spending to balance the budget, one way he's proposing to balance it is by reducing the required pension contributions. The second kind of reason of why this is concerning is that the state, prior to the current governor, has had a long history of underfunding the pension systems. And the pension systems right now are in a decades-long funding plan that's supposed to get them from being very underfunded where they are today to about 90% funded in 2045. And the governor is proposing to augment that funding plan, which in turn would reduce the state's required contributions for the 2020 fiscal year.
So legally, how would the governor be able to accomplish this? What kind of maneuvering will be needed?
That's an excellent question. So right now, the state's annual pension contributions are subject to a continuing appropriation. That means that absent any legislative changes, the state will have to pay the amount of money that's required by the current funding law. So the governor's proposal is to change aspects of the pension code and specifically to change the target for getting to 90% funded from 2045 out to 2052. And by kind of stretching that timeline out, the state's required contributions would decrease. And then he's also proposing to make a pension acceleration program that's temporary to make that permanent, which would save a little bit of money. But the bulk of the savings, nearly $1 billion of that $1.1 billion in savings, would come from stretching out the timeline for getting to that 90% target.
Governor Pritzker is also calling for a graduated income tax, hoping to have that in place in a couple of years. So is it possible that this change could bring in more revenue that could be used to pay down pension debt? And if that's done, would that mean that his current pension proposal isn't a bad idea after all?
Yeah, so you're raising an important kind of question. The governor's budget proposal has kind of overall pension plan in it, and there's kind of four different components of it. And so one component of it is that should there be a graduated income tax, that a portion of the revenue raised from that would be dedicated to the pension systems. So essentially, we could think of that as new revenue dedicated to paying down the unfunded pension liabilities. That could be a good thing potentially, but that is predicated on a graduated income tax structure being approved by voters, which couldn't happen until the 2020 general election. So it's a few years kind of down the line versus the other aspects of the proposal that are incorporated into the 2020 budget would be extending that timeline to reduce the required pension contributions in the short term. So that's kind of a long way of saying the overall net picture is a little unclear because there's so many different components of this overall proposal, and we haven't seen a really thorough analysis of all the different components and kind of what would happen if only some of the components materialized. So what happens if we never have a graduated income tax structure? Is the state's pension system going to be in an overall kind of worse situation then?
I'm Daisy Contreras for Statewide. I'm joined by Amanda Cass, Associate Director of the Government Finance Research Center at the University of Illinois in Chicago. And we're talking about Governor Pritzker's proposal to reduce payments to the state's five pension systems. Amanda, just to clarify, you've said that the $1.1 billion that's not going toward covering the pension systems should not be considered as a sort of savings for the state. So we shouldn't even see it as that. Why is that?
So I wouldn't characterize the $1.1 billion all as savings. So a portion of it, a smaller portion, is savings, and that's by allowing some people who are already in the pension systems to kind of participate in a buyout program. So the reduction in the required contribution from the buyout program is savings, but the reduction in the contributions due to extending the timeline past 2045 isn't savings in the long run, because the state will end up having to make increased contributions in the future. So it'll actually cost the state more in the long term. And because we don't have kind of thorough analysis on that aspect of the governor's proposal or the other areas of the proposal, we don't know exactly how much that will cost the state in the long run or whether the cost of that is offset by some of the other proposals that are mentioned in the budget.
In the last few years, like you have said, Amanda, we have failed as a state to make these payments as is mandated by law. Do you think that having Governor Pritzker's ideas on the table is better than having nothing at all to resolve the state's pension issues?
I think it's important that we kind of try to understand what exactly is the problem that we're trying to solve. Is the problem that we're trying to solve the financial condition of the pension systems? If that's the problem that we're trying to solve, then we would be putting more money into the pension systems now than is required by state law. That's very different than, I think, what is trying to be accomplished by this proposal, which is to create budgetary relief by decreasing the state's required pension contributions. So in other words, I think the approach is that the pension contributions are seen as kind of burdensome for the overall state budget, and so they're trying to reduce those contributions. But doing so can exacerbate the underfunding of the pension systems.
So far, we've talked graduated income tax, about revenue that could be used for pensions and other state needs in the future. But can you summarize how this budget proposal compares to previous plans that we've had?
To me, one thing that was really interesting about this budget is that it wasn't just a sort of hold-the-line placeholder budget while the state kind of tries to get a graduated income tax. So instead of kind of just maintaining the level of spending that had been occurring, what you have in the budget is you have proposals from the governor for some increased spending on new programs or expanding programs. So it's a rather kind of ambitious budget proposal, I would say.
That's Amanda Cass with the University of Illinois at Chicago talking about Governor Pritzker's proposed pension changes. She talked with our Daisy Contreras. Flooding along the Mississippi River is providing some real-world lessons for students at the Western Illinois University campus in the Quad Cities, as Herb Trix explains.
The director of the Institute for Environmental Studies, Roger Viadero, says students have been able to take what they learn in class and apply it to part of the campus in Moline that's been underwater for about a month.
You know, we collectively all have the opportunity as we're working to like look out onto one of the world's largest, most significant river systems worldwide. So that's really great. But lately, that huge river system's becoming a part of WIU Quad Cities' front yard.
To keep the lesson simple, Viadero decided to focus on the river's depth and velocity, as measured on the curb in front of the building. The recent speed of the water has been 1.8 miles per hour, nearly twice the normal speed here.
So normally, a place where we shouldn't even have any water is inundated with water, in some cases up to 34 inches of water, and we've got a speed that is that you'd find somewhere in the actual river proper under normal circumstances.
Viadero believes the damage caused by this flood will be significant because of the speed of the water, the depth, and how long the flood has lasted. I'm Herb Trex. Congress debates how to manage flooding and pay for damages. A federal agency plans to change the way flood insurance rates are calculated. It will affect how much homeowners pay in premiums, and it may reduce the burden on taxpayers who frequently have to bail out the National Flood Insurance Program. Michelle O'Neill reports next year that program will implement what FEMA officials call Risk Rating 2.0.
That is the last thing you want to hear inside your home, no matter where you live. But for decades, the Federal Emergency Management Agency has based flood insurance rates on one factor, whether a home is located in or out of a floodplain. David Marstead is the chief executive of the National Flood Insurance Program.
There aren't near enough people with flood insurance, and about 30% of the properties in the high-risk area have coverage, and about 4% nationally outside the high-risk area. So we have a lot of work to do in making sure people understand flood insurance is their first line of defense to recover from flooding events, and they need to be talking with their insurance agent and their insurance company. A lot of people believe that their homeowner policy or their renter's policy provides them with flood insurance coverage, and they'll find that it doesn't. So we're doing everything we can to try to increase the number of people that are covered.
People also don't understand how the agency calculates a property's flood risk. The current method can be inaccurate and unfair. Marstead says Risk Rating 2.0 will incorporate best practices to help fix those problems using lots of data plus new technology.
Such as different types of flood, like heavy rainfall from hurricane, river overflow, coastal surge, also, for example, the distance a building is to the coast or a river, and the cost to rebuild a specific home. But we're also addressing an inequity that has developed since the current rating structure was developed with some minor modifications since the early 1970s, and that is that lower valued homes are paying proportionately more than higher valued homes.
Lynn McChristian is the spokeswoman for an industry group called the Insurance Information Institute. She agrees the program's flood risk rating system must change.
Many of the flood policies it issues are underpriced. So people are not paying the proper amount for the level of risk that they represent. And proof of that is that the National Flood Insurance Program is $30 billion in debt. So it's paying out more in claims than it's taking in premium, and that's not sustainable.
Private insurance companies would quickly go out of business using the federal government's pricing model. McChristian says you can guess who pays the program's debt.
The way the National Flood Insurance Program is set up now is it puts taxpayers on the hook to bail out communities and individuals, and that's not a proper model going forward when we're having more flood events occurring in the country.
FEMA plans to implement Risk Rating 2.0 within 2 years for single-family homes, but it's only a small part of the solution. Reform of the entire National Flood Insurance Program came up repeatedly at a recent congressional reauthorization hearing. Wisconsin Representative Sean Duffy said, "Last year, expenses outstripped revenue by more than $6.5 billion, and Congress forgave $16 billion of its debt."
But I also think we have to address these repetitive loss properties. They're 2% of the properties, but they account for 24% of the costs. 2% of the properties account for 24% of the costs. We got to address that.
I'm Michelle O'Neill.
That wraps up another edition of Statewide. We're glad you could join us and be with us at this time next week. We'll have a special program examining the push for Illinois to legalize recreational marijuana. A series will be airing on many of these stations, and we'll provide a recap on Statewide. Find this episode and past episodes at statewideshow.com. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.